Sunstone Foundation presents the conflict between science and religion, reflections of a geologist, and Mormonism and creationism. Recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel Utah in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
It's here at the Sunstone Symposium. We'll be hearing from three people today. Morris Peterson, who is a professor currently at BYU. He is a stake president. He received his undergraduate degree in geology from BYU and his PhD from the University of Iowa. After that, he taught for 4 years at American University in Washington, D.C., and for the last 20 years has been at Brigham Young University. He will speak on the conflict between science and religions, reflections of a geologist. He will be followed by Dwayne Jeffrey. Dwayne Jeffrey is associate professor of zoology at Brigham Young University. He received his undergraduate degree at Utah State in wildlife ecology, and his master's and PhD in zoology and genetics at Berkeley, and his primary interest is in evolutionary genetics. He will be followed, who will give comment, by Cedric Davern, who is a professor of biology at the University of Utah. He is the author of articles in both Sunstone and Dialogue, dealing with creationism and evolution, two worldviews. We'd like to hear from these gentlemen in the order in which they were introduced, and if we have time following their remarks, we will open it up for discussion.
It's nice to be here and exchange some ideas with you. Titus Andronicus says of the rocks upon which he is lying, quote, "A stone is silent and offendeth not," unquote. Shakespeare's meaning is clear, but to a geologist, a rock is neither silent nor offensive, while to some, rocks indeed seem to offend their beliefs. Teaching geology, one is daily confronted with three seemingly unsolvable conflicts between science and religion. These troublesome areas, the age of the earth, the fossil record and organic evolution, and hominid fossils, seem to defy our best efforts at resolution. The problems persist in spite of determined efforts by the faithful scientists and the scientific faithful. Perhaps Christianus Huygens was right when he suggested 200 years ago that there was, quote, "things which the supreme creator seems to have kept for his own knowledge," unquote. Carl Sagan also offers good advice on these matters, saying, quote, "I think it wise when coming face to face with such profound mysteries to feel a little humility," unquote. Science is a process, a method of learning which is continually modified by improved observations and new discoveries wrought from the universe in which we live. In our religion, authority is derived from the scriptures, our living prophet, and other general authorities. Science, on the other hand, lacks an authoritative structure beyond consistency with the sum of our observations. Furthermore, as Karl Popper asserts, science must be falsifiable. In science, nothing is beyond criticism. Certainly, some theories in science remain strong after centuries of testing. With the passage of time, such theories take on the status of the laws of science. Newtonian mechanics is a classic example of a law. The laws governing moving bodies in space have survived scrutiny for several hundred years. The results of their validity are displayed by the remarkable success of our modern spacecraft. The flight of Voyager 2 illustrates the precision of our understanding. Launched into space in 1977, it has achieved successful encounters with each of the outer planets. Barring unforeseen difficulties, in August 1989, it will photograph the planet Neptune 12 years after its departure from Earth. Certainly, our understanding of the laws of motion have reached a high state of refinement. The theory of evolution has survived for well over 100 years. It has been refined and perfected throughout those years, and with each test, it grows more firmly rooted. evolution is a much stronger theory today than in those days when Dr. James E. Talmage, whose advanced education was in geology, wrestled with the issue as he taught geology at Brigham Young University and later at the University of Utah. All scientific conclusions, be they hypotheses, theories, or laws, are in time self-correcting. Constant reevaluation in light of new observations subjects each conclusion to intense scrutiny. A faulty interpretation will simply not stand up to constant criticism. Scientists will ultimately expose the errors in scientific theory. As the number of scientific observations expand, the constraints or limits imposed upon possible interpretations become more restrictive. As more data become available, the number of possibilities available to the theorizer becomes smaller. How then does a layman evaluate various scientific theories? In truth, the layman or even the scientist out of his or her specialty has difficulty making such judgments. This difficulty lies at the root of popular fads in science. There was great interest by the public following the appearance of Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision in 1950. The book was widely discussed, but as scientific scrutiny shed light on the flaws of his thesis, the book lost its luster. Likewise, the biblical flood and the ice epics published in 1966 by Donald Patton has had a similar fate. Once held by many laymen in our church as the key to reconciling science and religion, Patton's film strip version of his book is rarely seen these days. Its ideas simply do not hold up under scrutiny. Donald Patton and others of the, quote, scientific creationist movement would, by legislative means, dictate their interpretation of science and religion to school children throughout the country. Fortunately for all of us, the movement has at least temporarily been slowed by major court defeats in Arkansas in 1981 and in Louisiana in 1985. Not everyone's opinion carries equal weight in scientific debate. The scientific method demands an understanding of and conformity to observed data. Scholars who have mastered an area of learning must be given more attention and credibility than a non-specialist in the area. To learn the essential data within a single scientific area of study requires years of dedicated work. As with all areas of human endeavor, seasoning comes slowly. The famous case of the so-called Piltdown Man is a classic example of the scientific method in action. The Piltdown fossil was found in a gravel pit in Sussex, England in 1912. It remained among the hominid fossils until 1953, when with new laboratory techniques available and the fresh insight of a new investigator, J.S. Weiner of Oxford proved it was a fake. Someone with considerable insight and understanding of such fossils had intentionally mixed the skull of a man with the jaw of an orangutan, both about 500 years old, and carefully altered in their appearance and structure to make their association seem natural. The perpetrator remains nameless to this day. Some think the hoax was a practical joke which got out of hand. Whatever the reason for the hoax, Piltdown Man is a classic example of the built-in, self-correcting mechanism of science. When flaws are detected, scientific theories are modified. If grossly in error, they are replaced by better theories, and the process repeats. Each passing cycle of testing, refinement, and adjustment brings us to a better understanding of reality or truth. When we have complete understanding, differences in our interpretations derived from religion and science, as they are now perceived, will cease to exist. The harmony we strive for will be achieved. But until then, we will have to deal with a certain amount of conflicting data. Consider some of the problems surrounding these three issues: the age of the Earth, the fossil record, organic evolution, and hominid fossils. The age of the Earth and other planets in the solar system are now thought to be 4.6 billion years. This number is derived from well-established theories of nuclear regarding the process and regularity of nuclear decay or radioactivity. The earth's great antiquity can perhaps be best appreciated when one compares the rocks to historical artifacts on earth. For example, early photographs of the Colorado Plateau preserve images of the local landscape spanning a century. Details of the landscape can be compared. On such photographs, a specific rock or clump of vegetation on a hillside is usually identical, or only slightly changed by erosive forces. Obviously, change comes very slowly to the Earth's surface. Compare this to Hadrian's Wall, which extends west of Newcastle in the northern part of England for a distance of some 70 miles. The wall was constructed by Roman soldiers nearly 2,000 years ago. The date is well established. The wall is in remarkably good repair. One can walk along its crest today for great distances, much as the Roman guards must have done so long ago. The great pyramids of Egypt have stood by the Nile for over 4,000 years. An observer today sees what those ancient builders created. Some of the facing stones have been removed to nearby Cairo for more modern structures. Otherwise, there has been little change. Standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon, a person can observe far below the Colorado River flowing through the canyon. The momentum of that river, measured by its mass and velocity, is enormous. On a quiet afternoon, sitting on the rim at Grand Canyon National Monument, it is possible to hear the sound created by the water rushing over the rapids at Lava Falls, nearly a mile away. What was it like before the dams were constructed on the river, when the water rushed unimpeded down the canyon? Obviously, the momentum was then even greater. This huge excavation is the work of the Colorado River. On any day, one can walk to the river's edge, sample the water, and see the sediment being carried by the river. Geologists say this sediment is evidence of the erosive effect of the river. The central issue is clear. If the Grand Canyon was carved by the action of the river, it obviously required a very long time to carve man-made stone structures in England and Egypt. Within the walls of the Grand Canyon, great unconformities can be seen, wherein several thousands of feet of rock have been eroded and later buried by younger sedimentary deposits. Entire mountain ranges have been destroyed by the effects of erosion. Elsewhere, the products of that destruction have been accumulated in a sequence of sedimentary rocks measuring thousands of feet in thickness, seen as the spectacular scenery of southern Utah. To square this kind of data with an earth which is supposedly only a few thousands of years old is an insurmountable problem. The second issue deals with the fossil record and the theory of evolution. Evolution is a theory which has attracted great interest both in and out of science. For instance, the work and writings of Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, a paleontologist and professor at Harvard University, arouses great interest among both scientists and laymen alike. The theory of evolution is not stagnant. Throughout the world, research papers are published monthly probing the subtle details of evolution. The process of scientific criticism works. If Darwin's brainchild contained a fatal flaw, by now it would have been exposed. That has not happened, and the likelihood of such ever happening grows dimmer with each passing decade. I have confronted this theory in the course of my own work in paleontology. I have studied fossils, collected fossils from rocks over much of the world, and my study supports the long-known sequence of gradual change in ancient life from simple to complex. The change in fossils, as one transcends the stratigraphic sequence, as I have witnessed them, are best described by the theory of evolution. There is no serious alternative theory which, as science requires, accommodates the observations cataloged by paleontologists over the past century. To abandon evolution before science can suggest an alternative theory is to abandon science for a different method of learning about the world in which we live. The final challenge is the ever-growing evidence of the ancient hominids which once lived on the earth. There was a time when the discovery of these fossils was a very rare event. This is no longer so. Within the past decade, great numbers of these fossils have been found by several groups of paleo anthropologists, especially those working in East Africa. There was a time when the discoveries consisted of bone fragments, a single bone, or a part of a skull. Then in 1974, Dr. Donald Johansson discovered Lucy in the Afar area of Ethiopia. This remarkable fossil included nearly half of the fossil bones of a single individual. The age of Lucy's remains is dated by radiometric methods at approximately 3.5 million years old. In the summer of 1984, the American Museum of Natural History in New York City assembled an exhibit containing virtually every important hominid fossil discovered thus far. Specialists from around the world gathered to get a first-hand look at the fossils. There was the Tong baby, the first early hominid fossil ever found, discovered in South Africa by Raymond Dart in 1924. There was an excellent cast of the bones of Lucy, a substitute for the original, since the Ethiopian government would not allow the actual fossil to leave the country. There were the well-known hominid fossils from all over the world, Peking, Java, Neanderthal, and the Australopithecines of Africa. For me, viewing this collection was a profound emotional experience. I felt strong feelings of awe and respect as I viewed these fossils for the last time in the museum, knowing I would never see them again like this. Before me were the remains of once-living creatures, God's creations. As I moved from Lucy through the intermediate types to a modern skull, I could see the patterns of change conclusively displayed. The cranium becomes larger, the face smaller. How does an LDS scientist handle these conflicts? Apostle James E. Talmage in 1931 offered this advice on this issue. Quote, "The body is no more truly the whole man than is the coat the body," unquote. The fossils on exhibit in New York were the fossilized remains of ancient skeletal parts. Science offers nothing concerning, as Talmage says, the, quote, "individual intelligence which existed before his earthly body was framed and shall exist after that body has suffered dissolution," unquote. The 4.6 billion years proposed as the age of the earth is but an instant compared to eternity. These same 4.6 billion years, however, loom large as we contemplate our own very brief earthly mortality. How does one reconcile the remains of the fossil record of once-living organisms with the oft-quoted scripture referring to the eternal state of Eden's creations? And Moses saying, quote, "By his," meaning Adam's, "fall came death." Again in the book of Moses, quote, "Man became the first flesh upon the earth." Fossils of plants and animals occur in rocks of the Precambrian Aeon. The oldest fossils, the remains of blue-green algae, occur in rocks as old as 3.2 billion years. Animal fossils are common at 570 million years. And some are known which are as old as 700 million years. It has been my personal experience that involvement with science, including these troublesome issues, has only strengthened my feelings of awe and appreciation for the work of the Creator. At no time in my life has my involvement with science led me to negative behavior. There are no unresolved issues involving the saving principles of the gospel. Our obligations as Latter-day Saints is clearly outlined in the Scriptures. If the Lord felt the need for strict conformity in our beliefs about the creative processes, He would surely have shared more with us in the Scriptures. To blame scientific theories for the shortcomings of human behavior seems unjustified. Worse, it removes the responsibility from the individual. A person prizing his or her membership in the church must learn to live with questions. Faith is one of the important lessons of mortality. We must learn to say, "I don't know," as well as "I know." We do not have answers for all questions, any more than we are able to prescribe a particular pattern for rearing children with guaranteed results. These words by Apostle Talmage, preserved as his epitaph, are worth remembering. Quote, "Within the gospel of Jesus Christ, there is room and place for every truth thus far learned by man or yet to be made known, unquote. God is the great creator, the grand harmonizer. When we come to know him, these and all other issues will become clear.
Having heard some of the hoots of enjoyment from through the panel here, I think maybe we're in the wrong room. Somebody's been getting off some good one-liners or something in there. There is an educational and theological question of rather pervasive concern in our society today that I would like to try to very briefly address this morning. Well, I don't know how brief it'll be. Told Rick, give him a certain amount of time and I can kind of expand or contract, and it seems like university professors are usually geared for about 50 minutes. I'll try to keep that contracted. The question that I would like to address in its baldest form is sometimes said this way. Now, I do not happen to agree with it, but it seems to be the one that we're always getting. That is that there are two basic approaches to explanations for our universe and our place in it. Really, there are many more than two, but the idea then is that it is a question of, as it is sometimes said, theism versus humanism. The idea that God created, or that evolution being the religion of humanism, as one often hears, evolution, which is always interpreted in an atheistic sense by its critics and some of its defenders, that the one has only these two issues, and that, you know, it's kind of a choose-ye-this-day type thing. Modern creationism, as it is known, represents a rather persistent challenge to the school systems, asking that they be included, indeed demanding that they deserve to be included in the curriculum as much as anything else, and that means in the science classroom. And I think we need to make distinctions between the science classroom and classrooms such as history and or social science. Since Latter-day Saints are interested in the welfare and betterment of society, the question is sometimes posed as to whether Latter-day Saints should be aiding, abetting, assisting, and allying with creationists in their fight to, as they put it, move God back into the classroom. It's that particular issue that I would like to address a bit today. I suggest that their fight is not our fight, and I do that for two reasons. One, Mormons are not creationists. Believing in creation does not make you a creationist. I have sometimes used some rather simple homilies like that, that living in a republic doesn't make you a Republican, or living in a democracy doesn't make you a Democrat, or being an adult doesn't make you an adulterer. But believing in creation does not make you a creationist. Those are defined terms. Second point I would make, and we'll try to present, is that creationism is totally antithetical to the qualities and characteristics that we need in modern society to bring about social decisions that rely upon both religious values and scientific data. Now, I have grounds here for hours of discussion. I want to clear that this paper is only an introduction, and hopefully during the question and answer period we may be able to explore some additional material. The title of our paper, then, is Mormonism and Creationism, the Critical Differences, and I might add in a difference it makes, but it seems that when I sent in the title, I added something about Adam's belly button, so we'll have to stop partway through for that. We'll have occasion to refer to a number of the items that Dr. Peterson has raised, and as far as Mormon statements go, I think that most of us will have at least some feel for the historical expressions on those topics in Mormon First Presidency circles, at least. There have been a number of reviewers over the last several years that have reviewed these topics in Mormonism. I think, for instance, of Jeff Keller and Richard Sherlock, who's here this morning, for instance, as having provided excellent analyses of those. Their upshot is that while there has been a wide range of ideas about these issues expressed by LDS members and general authorities, the First Presidency and the Church itself have refrained from establishing specific tenets as official doctrine, and have made it clear, generally speaking, that these are open issues. So I will assume that we here all share some sense of the richness and openness of our official commentary and doctrinal base, and recognize also that the basic philosophy of Mormonism is vastly different from those customarily associated with traditional Christianity, that both in its scriptures and its prophetic commentary, Mormonism shares many large areas of agreement with science that are not traditionally shared by traditional Christianity. Those points are sometimes contested, but I think they are sufficiently well established that I won't do anything more with them. Creationism is not as well known in our particular area. Creationism is not a single and distinct entity. It's a collective term that's standardly applied to a rather loose amalgamation of diverse groups, frequently competing groups, and or individuals which share some unifying religious themes. There is no central organization to creationism. There is no central body of individuals to coordinate their goals, activities, or beliefs. There is no one who really speaks for creationism. The creationist groups differ widely in the image they project and in the activities in which they engage. But with all that said, it's clear that it is religious belief that unifies them as a group and nothing else. There are varying levels of sophistication among the groups. There are those who still believe a flat earth, that the earth is flat, and ardently defend that. There are those, on the other hand, who believe that that has long since been established otherwise, and so they talk on a different level. There are some groups who make distinction between what they call creation science and what we might call creation theology. That is, there is the argument that from science one can generate certain statements about our universe and its origins that are independent of any theological statements about it. And that becomes a critical distinction. In truth, the people who make that distinction, their critics nor other creationist groups, nobody can keep that distinction straight. That initial statement gets so quickly blurred with theological argument that it's really artificial and propagandistic and rather useless. But I will try to maintain a little bit of that this morning. The persuasiveness of whatever is called creation science is not enough to sustain the movement. All the pleas for support, for finances, from creationists are based, almost without exception, in religious terminology. We're helping to establish the kingdom. We're helping to bring God into the classroom. We're helping to do this, that, and the other. We're upholding the faith once delivered to the saints. It's the religious motive that sustains it, not the science. And I think that distinction has to be made clear also. The science end is a facade. A brief history, I think, will be in order. Evolution, as a major concept in Western society as far as we're concerned today, can be dated to 1859 and the publication of Darwin's book On the Origin of Species. Now, we often have the idea, it's diligently promulgated in our society, that there was an immediate clash between Darwin's ideas and the religions of the day. That really is not correct. In truth, his ideas found acceptance most quickly among the religionists. Most of his attackers came from science. As one recent historical treatment summarizes it, with but few exceptions, the leading Christian thinkers in Great Britain and America came to terms quite readily with Darwinism and evolution. But we humans like controversy, confrontation, and so we have built up and I think blown out of proportion those confrontations that did exist, particularly the 1860 debate between Thomas Huxley and Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, of the Anglican Church. Though Darwin himself became an agnostic, not an atheist, an agnostic, he maintained deep personal relationships with a number of the leading religious figures of the day. At his death, he was given full formal recognition by the church. Eulogistic sermons were preached in his behalf at both Westminster Abbey and at St. Paul's Cathedral. A memorial fund in his behalf was begun, sponsored partly by the Archbishops of York and of Canterbury and the Bishop of London. And he lies buried today in England's leading religious cemetery, Westminster Abbey. There were, of course, religious groups that did not find easy accommodation, or even a working relationship. There were early groups, Victorian Society, some others that I think I'll ignore for this morning, and I'll zero in mainly on the American situation, where in 1941, a group of scientists, all with religious background, evangelistic or fundamentalistic religious background, joined together to establish an organization known as the American Scientific Affiliation. Their goals were to investigate the relationships between Darwinism and Christianity as they knew it. They did make a commitment that many of them have made quite a point of, that, you know, we decided that nothing was too good for God. We would be as honest and straight with the data as we could be, and we would go from there. Over the next 20 years, though they all started off as anti-evolutionists, the overwhelming personality evident in the American Scientific Affiliation was that of theistic evolution. That is, that God had operated through evolutionary means to bring about living forms. By 1963, there were those who could no longer find that idea comfortable, so they broke away and established their own group, the Creation Research Society, which includes as part of its membership not only an advanced degree in science, but essentially an oath, a statement of belief, which essentially bars the kind of development that the American Scientific Affiliation underwent. The Creation Research Society continues today as the most visible of the creationist groups, and so I'll probably tend to rely on them more than any others. There are other groups that have either broken off or begun up on their own. A few of them. Creation Science Research Center, Bible Science Association, Students for Origin Research, etc. The groups are dominated by a relatively small number of Christian fundamentalistic groups. That is, their members are primarily Baptists, Missouri Synod Lutherans, Seventh-day Adventists, some Pentecostals, Disciples of Christ, Disciples of Christ, Church of Christ. Now, there are many Baptists, Lutherans, Adventists who don't share the creationist point of view, but creationism as a movement is kept alive by members of those particular groups. In creationist literature, one can find all kinds of ideas. Some are marvelously creative. Some are laughable. I'm tempted to illustrate, but I think I won't, primarily because that's not the best of creationism and because we have some screamers in our own literature, and in fairness, I don't want that to represent us either. So I'll just make that and move on from there. The basic positions of creation science, as their proponents periodically define it, would include the following. And again, I say no group. These have never been voted on. These are the ones I tend to draw from their literature. One, the argument is the universe had to have a creator. This is an argument that natural laws are insufficient, and indeed they are counterproductive in the process of creation. Secondly, it is argued that natural laws are laws which were instituted after the fall of Adam, and they represent an inferior and in most ways a poor, compromised set of laws necessitated by the rebellion of Adam and Eve in the garden. God really set this up on completely different laws, laws that are no longer operable anywhere in the universe, end quote, and hence not subject to scientific analysis. But that since the fall of Adam, second law of thermodynamics and other things have come into play, and we've been running ever since on a downhill type series. Thirdly, the universe is young. It is argued to have had a finite origin and beginning approximately 6 to 10,000 years ago. There's some stretching among different groups and people on that, but that's the basic position. Fourthly, the fossil-bearing strata, or rocks to which Dr. Peterson has referred, are said to have resulted from a major single cataclysmic event that occurred about 4,000 to 4,600 years ago. Years ago, not before Christ, but years ago. We're talking 2,000 to 2,500 B.C. That at that time, the flood of Noah laid down all the fossil-bearing strata that we presently see, with very, very tiny exceptions. So all of our mountains here then are said to be the result of one single event. Fifthly, living organisms do have some built-in genetic variation, but there are fixed, immutable limits beyond which they cannot change. Now, on those particular points, those five basic points, many Mormons could find a good deal of agreement. It would be, for instance, a rare Mormon who I think would not respect the position that the universe had a creator. But the definitions of creator then become to be critical, and they turn out to be a major distinction between Mormons and creationists. On other major points, however, Mormonism either emphatically disagrees with the creationists or has a wide variety of belief that's never been institutionalized into any formal doctrine. Now, it turns out, no creationist I've ever seen or heard of is satisfied with staying on those positions, because immediately behind them comes in the theological arguments about what has to be the case. Separating out these items that we have looked at are merely a strategic maneuver to try to get into the nation's classrooms, and that has been abundantly documented and recognized. Creationists then will argue from their theology that there are further necessary concepts that have to come in with this. Now, we turn out to use some of the same vocabulary that creationists use on some things. We have overlap with their vocabulary, but in almost all cases, we define and emphasize and limit those words quite differently from what creationists do. A fundamental concern has to do with the sovereignty of God. To the creationist, God is the absolute sovereign creator of the universe. The term is foreign to us in LDS parlance. To the creationist, this means that God is the absolute lawgiver. He was there all alone, before anything else was. There was not even space. There was only this God. And he spoke into being all other things, including space, time, matter, personality, life. All those then have so-called contingent being. Only God has necessary being, that is, he has to exist and cannot not exist. All other things, including space, are totally contingent upon God's will. And if he happens to will them out of existence, that's fine. He won't, it is asserted. But he could. He is then absolutely sovereign. When Mormons use the word absolute and some of those other words, we tend to use it in a relatively relative sense. To the creationist, then, God created ex nihilo, that is, out of nothing. He spoke things into being. As a result of the spoken command, all these things we've talked about, time, space, matter, etc., all began to exist. Light also began to exist. Light also began to exist only at that point. One of the earliest definable beliefs in Mormon philosophy is its total and complete rejection of creation ex nihilo. And it completely undermines Mormon theology in ways that have been reviewed for us in Dialogue and Sunstone by Kent Robeson, Blake Osler, Sherlock, Keller, others. Truman Madsen, B.H. Roberts, Kendall White, Randall Rich, many of our people have discussed these issues, and I only wish that they were better known among the Latter-day Saints because of this very fundamental difference between two really incompatible systems. Nextly, the Creator is said by creationists to be omnipotent, that is, all-powerful. This seems to follow, obviously, from my statements about sovereignty and creation ex nihilo. God is to be unchallengeable in his power and ability. There are various rationales, none of them very thorough, about why then he continues to permit a world of imperfection, evil, and suffering. And it is that that has resulted in the so-called death of God movement of modern Christianity. In Mormon literature, the word omnipotent is also used commonly. The closest, I think, in our LDS literature to the creationist point of view are some of the expressions in the last decade or so by Elders Bruce McConkie and Neil Maxwell. People who tried to talk to Brother McConkie were not successful in establishing dialogue. Brother Maxwell ended up with a letter which he asked Blake Osler to publish, indicating that he certainly does not mean those terms in the sense that the philosophers and the creationist meaning of them embodies. Omniscience is the next quality we need to mention. Creationists are insistent on this term in its most usual Christian sense, that God knows everything in the past, the present, the future, anything that ever will be. Again, we have used that a bit in Mormon theology, Brother Maxwell, Brother McConkie particularly, but we have tremendous difficulties with that because of the Mormon reliance on free agency. If indeed all the future is mapped out and cannot anything occur other than what must occur, then of course we are all robots and free will has some problems. So Mormons wrestle with this. Creationists seem never to really bring up the issue in any substantive way. It is a fundamental difference. It will be clear now,
I hope,
that a good deal of differences between creationism and Mormonism revolve around the literalness of scriptural interpretation. And while both claim to interpret the scriptures rather literally, it's very clear they don't interpret them the same. Let me, for instance, quote Henry Morris, who's probably the leading light in the creationist movement, about the Bible and science. "The real truth of the matter is that the Bible indeed is verbally inspired and literally true throughout. Whenever it deals with scientific or historical matters of fact, it means exactly what it says and is completely accurate. When figures of speech are used, their meaning is always evident in context, just as in other books. There is no scientific fallacy in the Bible at all. Science is knowledge, and the Bible is a book of true and factual knowledge throughout on every subject with which it deals. The Bible is a book of science. Considering Mormon's Eighth Article of Faith, I think we'll see some immediate differences. My next point deals with the age of the physical earth, to which Dr. Peterson. We've indicated earlier that the anti-evolutionists, originally an American scientific affiliation, moved from a belief in a young-aged earth to a belief in an old-aged earth, and then into a belief of theistic evolution. The present leaders of the creationist movement, Henry Morris, others among them, find themselves combating the same overwhelming scientific data, and possibly even scriptural data, that indicate that the earth is very old. As anti-evolution, well, throughout the last several hundred years of Western civilization, the data have piled up more and more, both from science and some from scripture, that the earth is old. Even before Darwin, it was recognized that a single catastrophic event cannot handle what we see out there in the rocks. Georges Cuvier, who was the father of comparative anatomy and paleontology, was not an evolutionist. He was a catastrophist, but he realized that even to explain the rocks he knew in Central Europe, he had to have at least 17 individual time-spaced catastrophes to begin to explain what was there. Modern Creation Research Society and others refuse to look at this kind of data. Many of their debaters will no longer even defend a young term Earth or argue that, well, it really doesn't matter much and there are other issues we ought to talk about more. However, from a theological point of view, they won't give up. They have to have it. I spent a couple of hours on the phone the other day with a young man working on a PhD in paleontology at Harvard. He was also a born-again Baptist. Tells me Southern Baptists are too liberal for him. And I said, wait a minute. You're working on the world's best-known paleontologists, and yet you believe in a 6,000-year-old earth. And he says, yes, I do. He says, I have two minds. My theological mind absolutely insists that it is 6,000 years old. It was created in six 24-hour days. He says, my science mind, there's no question. It's very, very old. And I said, how do you put it together? And he said, I don't. I said, you know, you're going to develop schizophrenia one of these days. We're going to have to clip your corpus callosum. And he said, well, right now I'm just trying to absorb. I can't even begin to try to put it together. But it has to be from the scriptures, and so is Henry Morris's argument, and indeed most others. Well, then how does a creationist square the data that the earth and the universe do appear to be old? It's done by invoking a doctrine of apparent age. And this is an incredible little piece of philosophical legerdemain. That is, that the earth and the universe only appear to be old. They really are not. To simply represent this, let me refer to one of Henry Morris's analogies. He says, Adam was created as a full-grown man in the Garden of Eden. Now, if you just look at him, you're going to say, hey, he had a childhood. And he grew up. He's got a past. He's got history. But that is not the case. God created him full-blown right here, adult and functioning. And the universe the same way. Brought up, and it's part of the subtitle of this talk, did Adam have a navel? For indeed, if God built him without having had a mother, he really has no need for a navel except as a lint collector. And if he had a navel, it would seem to imply that he had a mother. And therefore he was a baby, and therefore he had history. Now, creationists have been developing this ever since it was first put out in a book a couple hundred years ago by Philip Gossa. He referred to this as the omphalos argument. Omphalos is the Greek word for navel. And his conclusion was that Adam didn't have a navel. That would make God into a deceiver. Modern creationists are really quite split on the issue. Some think he did, some think he didn't. I don't know. All Mormon sources, however, and this does make a difference, all Mormon sources insist that Adam did have a navel. All possibilities that we have ever proposed in the church for the origin of Adam, be that transplantation, born on another earth, born here in mortality as other mortals have been, as Joseph F. Smith put it, or through divine evolution, also coming from the Joseph F. Smith period, all of those would suggest that Adam had a navel. So if that is significant, that is also a difference. Okay. But Henry goes on to argue about starlight coming in from distant stars, about the way the rocks look, about radiometric dating, all these kinds of things, that, you know, those only indicate the Earth is old. It really isn't. Now, why would God create it that way? Here's where Henry starts to slip a little. He says God has to create it that way because it's the only way he can create, fully formed and functioning, end quote. I don't have time to explore it, but I wonder what this does with the concept of omnipotence that he has also developed for us elsewhere. Well, the length of the creation days then is a matter of some concern to us. To Henry and the literal creationists, the earth was created in six little 24-hour days, etc. I think we know a Mormon points of view on that, so I will not refer to those further. An interesting difference has to do with exobiology. That is, does life exist anywhere else in the universe other than on this planet and the life associated with the Genesis creation? Creationists are willing to accept non-earthly life only as it goes to God, angels, and demons. Absolutely nothing else. This earth is at least the theological center of the universe, and for some of them it is the physical center as well. Mormons will have difficulty with that since they believe life has been existing elsewhere in the universe for long extended periods of time and that this earth is by no means the center of any universe. Now there are really three groups of creationists on this point, and I think it is well that we distinguish them. The scientific creationists, as they call themselves, are considered by other creationists to be the liberal wing of creationism, because they tend to accept the heliocentric solar system, the sun in the middle and the planets orbiting around it. There is then a moderate wing that says the earth is spherical, but it does not circle the sun. The sun goes around it. And so they are still on the old geocentric system. There are major groups with that point of view. Then there are the really fundamental creationists, who are the flat earthers, and who argue not only does the sun go around the earth or across the heavens, but that the earth is flat. And that is a point of view held by a minority group, but they are the ones who picture themselves as the believing in the one true religion of the Bible. I think I shan't take additional time with that. I'd like to shift to another point of view. And that gets back to the original question, that is, since there are many problems in modern society which require the input of both science and religious concerns, does creationism offer a viable alternative that deserves our support? I think we'll see, hopefully by now, that we may be buying something else other than what we think if we're just taken in by some of the creationists' superficial rhetoric. Do we join them in our fight? My argument will be that creationism is antithetical to the resolution of critical questions. My major premise for this comment is that healthy religion and healthy science are both critical for a healthy society. That must be remembered. Both are critical. From my point of view, humans are just too diverse to find all their spiritual, emotional, intellectual expression in any one system. But the long history of science and religion makes it tough to talk about syntheses between them. We've all got intellectual hobgoblins battling around in our psyche that make it difficult to really address these issues precisely. In recent years, creationists have been able to muster sufficient support in two states, Arkansas and Louisiana, to get passed into law bills that require equal leaders of the opposition to those creationist laws have been in both Arkansas and Missouri largely or even majorly made up of religious leaders. Religious leaders who argue, recognize, and defend that creationism is inimical to legitimate religion and that they are contributing to an increasing disrespect for creationism in our country and a weakened ability of religious leaders to make meaningful input in society's decisions. So the challenges to the creationists have come very, very largely from religious leaders. Now, science, with all its flaws, is a self-correcting, self-analytical system. It's got a lot of egos, a lot of power plays, that's all true, but at rock bottom, as Dr. Peterson has suggested, it is a self-correcting system. I am watching the clock, I hope. Science is a system, however, that is based independently of race, religion, and culture. I do not suggest that all interpretations of data are similarly free, but the data are, to a very large extent, free from such. Religion is not. It is much influenced by race, religion, and culture. And when we come then to make social decisions based on religious beliefs, it comes usually only when one of us undergoes a conversion to someone else's religious belief. And then we agree on what ought to be done about it. My thesis today is that most religions offer answers only when everyone else will dance to their tune. That when they gain enough people by conversion or by Christ coming at the end of the world to either impose or make persuasive their own brand of utopia, then and then only will society's problems be healed. But I think it's clear that conversion to any religion is just too slow. And so the question is, what can serve as the common language in society on which we can dialogue on critical issues? I argue that creationism complicates that process. Just for a very quick summary, there's some studies early in this century pursued the question of which religions were pursuing the majority of scientists. I think it'll come as no surprise to know that those religions which were comfortable with the idea of God working through natural laws, of God and man as partners in a better world, were the major producers of scientists. There are so-called religions of accommodation that help you accept your misery, but they don't drive you to change anything. Judeo-Christianity has been the major producer of scientists, and among Judeo-Christianity, among the Christian groups particularly, the ones based on the idea that God works through natural laws, are the ones that have been by far the most productive of scientists, people who can speak both a science and a religious language, if you will. The religions that argue that science is antagonistic to Scripture or to religion, that science and intellectualism are the arm of flesh, tests of faith, antichrist, have been the poor producers. Let's get specific. Among Christian denominations, Mormons have ranked very high in the production of scientists traditionally. I would refer you to the handout we just gave you, and we'll take a look at some of those. Also high have been Unitarians, Congregationalists, Friends, Methodists, etc., the so-called mainline Protestant groups. Ranking lowest among Christian religions in the studies done in terms of scientific productivity were Roman Catholics, and just above those are the Baptists, Lutherans, Disciples of Christ. Do those groups sound familiar? Those are the modern-day creationists, the heart and core of the creationist movement. And these, I think, bring out an important point, that creationism is at heart inherently antithetical, antagonistic to science. As exemplified by its major group, it really prevents scientific inquiry, education, and productivity. Now, there's one further point, I think, that I'd like to make for Mormons before I quit. On the handout that we gave you, we'll see the results of studies which ask the questions, which universities, which states in the country are most productive of scientists? And there are some interesting patterns that come out of this. It turned out that among the universities, asking the question, among all those who get a baccalaureate degree at a university, what percentage of them go on to become professional scientists? There were two main clusters that dropped out of the data. One were the Jewish universities in New York, that is the heavily Jewish-dominated ones, CCNY, Brooklyn, Queens, and Yeshiva. And the other cluster was the three major schools in Utah at that time, BYU, Utah State, University of Utah. Weber State at this time was just building. And as a state, Utah was by far and away the most productive of scientists. I call your attention now to these columns that you look there. Check out physical sciences. Utah is third in production. Biological science, Utah first. Social sciences, Utah first. Arts and professionals, Utah about sixth. Education, Utah second. Then we go to combined fields. Utah with a productivity index of 52.5 compared to the second place, 40.4 for Iowa. More than 25% above the nearest competitor on the terms of this index. Now, that's really not a percentage index, so, I mean, let's be a little careful with that. From 1920 to 39, we see Utah again on top. From 1961, that really was to 1959, we again see Utah on top by a very, very sizable margin. Let's now go to the bottom of the list. Just the last three columns, and let's look about the last 10 or so on each one. The bottom, Tennessee, Texas, Oklahoma, Florida, South Carolina, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia. the right-hand column, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas, Arizona, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, Mississippi. What do we notice about those states? These are the states of the creation of strongholds. These are the states dominated by the religions that push creationism. Does it make any sense, then, to try to adopt the programs of those religions to foster a scientifically and theologically integrated and sophisticated society? Can we really address the social issues by taking those kinds of programs? I think the answers are pretty clear. What happens to education in general, and education, and then science education particularly? My argument then would be that we as a people have no business aligning ourselves with the creationist movement at all. We have a very different philosophical basis and a very different role to play in social decisions. We've got a lot of work to do. The last 30 years in the church have seen a slide toward the creationist position. We won't document that further, but it is pervasive in our lesson manuals, our seminary and institute system, the general discourse among our people, the general scientific awareness evident in our society. Our people are tending to go into law, to business, to the health professions, but we seem to be turning out fewer and fewer scientists. We need better data. These are the latest I know of that are available. But it also seems that while we have some challenging work to do, we would be foolish to align ourselves with the creationist. Our differences and the stakes they represent are too great. Thank you.
The purpose here is to comment on the two previous speakers. I will use this license to comment to add something original of my own, but I will stick to my charge as best I can. Dr. Jeffries examines the question as to whether it would be in the church's interest to align itself with the creationist crusade. After remarking upon the substantial number of differences in points of particular and sometimes very significant belief, and after harking back to an era a generation or so ago when science and religion enjoyed a far more congenial coexistence in this community than it seems to today, he urges that the church maintain, if not improve, its position of suspended judgment, which I look upon as a form of unreliable, benign neglect. With respect to the differences of religion and science, with respect to their views of humanity and the ordering of the cosmos. He urges this because he believes that science properly applied can be a source of power for the good in society and that is not responsible for the perceived falling away of people from their commitment to the good. And this is a charge that is often made under the rubric of secular humanism, of which science is a major activity. And that people who are attracted to science and its practice, or at least to propagate its findings, are almost invariably crippled morally. Both Peterson and Jeffries, in a sense, offer their personal testimony that they have not been so crippled. I, unfortunately, cannot offer the same testimony because I know I'm bad, but I don't know if it's because of my science or something else. There's a confounding of the issue. So that to join the creationists for the Mormon Church would be to forge an uncomfortable alliance at best on a mistaken view as to the source of the perceived malaise of society. It's very clear that creationists and the churches from which they are derived and people gathered here today do have a deep concern about the way they think the world is heading. And that's about the only common ground. While Dr. Jeffries has pointed out a considerable number of differences in this belief system between creationists and yourselves, the fact that there are strong points of Mormon belief as to the nature of the cosmos and its genesis is of significance to me. Because unless this informal policy of suspension of concern about the conflicts between the contemporary findings of science and the revealed truths of religion can be kept out of the arena of discourse and conflict by the active self-denial of the church leadership, I believe, as Dr. Jeffries has intimated, that the trend that he has seen and that I have heard about is bound to continue. Unfortunately for me, I see nothing that encourages me in believing that the benign neglect will continue, because I don't quite understand the basis of it in any organized way. In my restricted readings of the few cases where there have been conflict in the past, namely in the letters between Henry Eyring and Joseph Fielding Smith, there was some indication that this was a matter of personal positions on these issues, and neither party wanted to bring them too forcibly into either the scientific or religious arena. This forbearance may be based on an idiosyncratic wisdom rather than on some systematic inherent nature of the church, and I would like either of my panelists to perhaps take this point up later on in the discussion. All this leads me to focus on the nature of science, to emphasize its limited scope and the limited status of that enterprise when it comes to knowing the truth, and that its claims are so modest as not to compete with the claims of absolute knowledge put forward by religion. I can comfortably do this because I do not have a stake in the truth. I don't have a stake in the truth because I have no way personally of recognizing it for what it is if it was presented to me on a platter. And that is because I am an agnostic. That you must know to understand my basis of the following argument. Now, I don't know whether I became an agnostic because I subsequently became a scientist, or whether I was a scientist before I was an agnostic, or the other way around. I seem to recollect that I was psychologically biased towards agnosticism from a very early age, rarely keeping out of trouble. The practice of science, unlike the practice of religion, which maintains that we are something more than complex machines, is predicated on a particular a priori interpretation of the world as nothing but, not something more, nothing but bits of stuff in motion, where the manifestations of stuffs and its motions are constrained by so-called natural laws, those regularities that make them intelligible and predictable to us and by us. In terms of its technological fruit, science has undeniably and profoundly changed the way we live, and it is this evidence of the powerful utility of scientific knowledge that persuades most of us to repose great confidence in it, even to the extent of confusing its theories with the truth. And despite the fact that some of its fruits are far more terrifying today than they are beneficent, the primary purpose of science, at least for the scientist, is to explain change, a phenomenon that since the beginning of recorded speculation about it has invited the dichotomous reaction of either being denied utterly as a reality, following the tradition of Parmenides, or taken as the entirety of reality after Heraclitus. This dichotomy is still with us today, in that scientists, on the one hand, have as a cardinal a priori assumption that both enables them to do science and governs them in the kinds of questions that they ask of nature. For them, change is more in the way of a transformation, more in appearance than in substance. This attitude to change allows it at least to be measured and expressed in mathematical terms, and thus shown to be consistent or lawful in the antecedents of its occurrences, and at most to be accounted for in terms of prior change in chains of causality in the billiard ball world of Laplace. Now that's to be contrasted with the other notions of change, which are really and strictly comings into being, ontological events if an agent is involved of creation, or spontaneous origins in their own right. And science doesn't deal with those sorts of things at all. They rule them out as not dealable with by the scientific method. While the nature of some of the agency of change, such as gravity, is quite mysterious, all change is treated continuously by scientists, even in the Newtonian theory for the origin of the species, where the elements of change must be open to direct observation in terms of mutation, and the accumulation of these changes under the ordering influence of the natural environment account for the evolutionists for the origin of the species. This other way of looking at change, namely as a succession of creations, ex nihilo, becomings in a strictly ontological sense, is congenial to some Christian theologies, if not to Mormonism, as has been pointed out this morning. Scientific descriptions are consummated in equations, not creations, and the genuine coming into being out of nothingness by definition falls outside the scope of scientific explanation at this time. Now, science itself is evolving, and I can't say what would be included in the rubric in the future. I can only tell you what has been included in the rubric in the past and what is now included in the rubric. There's nobody out there dictating what science is. Science has to be looked at in a passive sense. You go out and observe what this activity entails and what are the beliefs of the people who've subscribed to it and how does it fit into society. And all these sorts of activities are free from any a priori biases as to what science really ought to be in any stage of history. Most scientists today, especially successful ones, have little time for and less patience with the assessment of the philosophical and more particularly the epistemological status of their activities. However, philosophers of science see the claim of science to be limited to the explanation of phenomena in terms of secondary causes. The divine has no place in modern scientific explanation, though many scientists may pray to God to inspire their ingenuity and facilitate their dexterity in their labors. Admittedly, things were quite different back in the days of Newton and Boyle, where the express purpose of science was to comprehend God's purpose itself, as it was believed to be revealed in the natural world, and to complement what was set down in Revelation. There is no doubt that this view is carried forward today by the more religiously inclined scientists in some areas, even though, for the most part, it has not the slightest influence on their daily practice of science, much in the way of the schizophrenic paleontologist can do orthodox paleontology while maintaining a very strict and absolute theological view. For example, Henry Eyring, the father of chemistry in Utah, followed this example, which he borrowed from his more illustrious predecessor, Boyle, the father of chemistry per se, by believing that in the fullness of time, the scientific understanding of natural phenomena and the meaning of revealed scripture properly interpreted would eventually converge on the same truths. In the meantime, for the sake of the integrity of the different modes of acquiring certain knowledge, the best strategy for Eyring was to let each approach the truth in its own way, free from interference from the other. It would appear that such mutual tolerance in what is what Jeffries is urging, and I would only add that the likelihood of this coming to pass will be a direct reflection of the confidence that scientists as scientists on the one hand have in their activity and the church leaders as believers on the other have in the robustness of their institution. If there is any nervousness about this, I would expect this would spawn some reactionary, conservative actions to protect what is perceived to be a weakening foundation. And that response. Galileo was one of the first modern scientists to urge this separation when he stated that the purpose of the scriptures was to teach us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Now, where the ultimate lack of conflict would rest so not so much on convergence on truth. You see, I want to make a distinction to what I've already said other people have said and interclade here a point of my own, namely that the lack of conflict may not in the future rest on the convergence, which is dearly to be hoped by people of Henry Eyring's persuasion, as it would be on an avoidance of the authority of the scriptures, or denying the authority of the scriptures in dealing with the how of things and restricting its scope to just dealing with the why, the purpose. There has been this attempt to divide up the epistemological field into the hows and whys and achieve a measure of priests, if you like, a concordat, a detente, where by virtue of each of these fields plowing separate territories would not in a categorical way ever interfere with each other, and thus they can peaceably go about their tasks without annoying each other. I share really neither version implied by this sort of optimism. There is a progressivism in Eyring's view, and I feel far more confident that we are damned to incomplete understanding for eternity. And the challenge is, how do we deal with this parlous state? Optimism is a wonderful feeling, but it can get you into trouble if the ground for it is inadequate. And so I would feel it would be better to be parsimoniously pessimistic and contemplate the possibility that we will never really understand anything at all to a degree that we would like to and give us psychological satisfaction. As a methodological tactic, Darwin recognized the need not to prematurely yield phenomena that are currently intractable to materialist explanation to the domain of God. He saw clearly, and he was one of the first to do this in his era, that science's role is to provide an explanation, and a materialist one at that, without regard to its relation to the absolute truth. In defining science in this way, where one is not pursuing truth as much as one is pursuing consistency, perhaps in this third way, instead of dividing the domains into the how and the why, we divide it between the absolute truth, which is the domain of religion, and internal consistency, which is the domain of science, perhaps we can minimize conflict. Today, scientists, by and large, recognize this as well, that there is a separation, and so they try to produce materialist hypotheses that parsimoniously and elegantly connect seemingly unrelated phenomena into a causal hierarchy, which in turn allows the prediction of further connections that can be tested for their validity. This is really a nutshell description of modern science. There is, however, a tacit recognition that the utility of these hypotheses and theories are not to be confused with their truth, in that the truth, if ever it would be stumbled upon, could not be recognized as such. So this is a meta-agnosticism. Not only that you don't know the truth, but that you would not recognize the truth if it was there before your eyes. Scientists are nonetheless enjoined to be truthful in the reporting of their results and credible in their undertakings, but the fruits of this virtuous endeavor can only be accorded the status of likely stories, where some may become to be more likely than others. But I would like to leave these metaphysical realms, where I hope I have left the impression that we ought to be more certain about what we don't know than about what we do, and turn to a more practical matter and take up Jeffrey's challenge as to what ought to be done, if anything, about the recent reburgeoning of the creationist movement. I believe he has put his finger on the most troublesome aspect of these latter-day creationists, and it is the disingenuousness of their leading advocates, for they will use whatever means is necessary to gain their particular end. And some of these means are not justifiable. They, for example, deliberately distort and occasionally suppress or make attempts to suppress the conclusions that have been the product of the credible evidence of sincere people as they attempt to justify the feasibility of and explain the mechanics of the origin of the species, including man, in materialist terms by the employment of an objective standard of shareable evidence and logic. Now, I'm not trying to justify science, because one can argue interminably as to whether we would be better off with it or without it, especially when one considers both the inadequate wisdom with which we've handled the fruits of science, and worse, the capacity for the abuse of it when it comes to dealing with the power conferred on us by its understandings. I'm just going to consider science as a cultural given, something which we can't avoid no matter how much we dislike it, if we do dislike it. Instead, I'm going to suggest that the creationist movement is but one instance of many that have continually plagued society throughout history, where people have used questionable means to obtain, for them at least, desirable ends. With the inception of free society in the modern era, the problem of questionable means has been much exacerbated by the great plurality and diversity of desired ends that is the very hallmark of a free society. Some of us may have the expectation that a free society would be a pleasant society to live in. I couldn't imagine a more cantankerous and argumentative environment in which to repose oneself. If you are seeking peace of mind, for God's sake, avoid a free society, as you won't be able to handle it. Such that there, in a free society, controversy and rancor divide the society to the point that it's often difficult to see the one goal that that society should share amongst its members and, of course, protect with all its vigor. That is, the enabling freedom should be cherished and preserved and extended, even though it results in us being surrounded by people with whom we are in passionate disagreement. I believe that the useful question to ask then is, how might a pluralistic free society modify its institutions to make controversy less shrill and the rancor less bitter? I argue maybe we can make life a little sweeter than it is. There is no doubt that over the years the public school system has become the prime forum for advocates of one kind or another who have sought to advance their interest by curricular means. The overall consequence of this has been the system's response to expand the curriculum well beyond its minimally controversial core of the three R's. The effort of organized creationists to both alter the treatment of evolution and to provide equal time for the presentation of the Genesis version of the cosmogony is but one, albeit remarkably successful one, as far as modifying the context of the contents of school biology goes. However, while these efforts focus on the current conclusions of scientific inquiry and not on science itself, I do not believe too much harm has been done to this point. You've got to have a relativistic view. What was it like prior to our concern, and what will it be like as these forces continue to have their action? And I don't worry about it too much, because I recognize that there is a very naive appreciation of science possessed by the young. It could not be otherwise. And, of course, sometimes by their teachers. They may be able to parrot off the current scientific conclusions accurately, but I don't think they have a knowledge at all in their head how this information that they so accurately parrot was arrived at. And they, of course, have no idea as to its status in an epistemological way. I don't think you can teach that sort of stuff in K-12. There may be the odd genius who can take a piece of it in. Indeed, rather than futilely debating the issues with creationists, as I have done in the past, I would think we should continue to resist, however, their unconstitutional efforts to legislate equal time for the presentation of a frankly religious view of the cosmogony in public school as we... Yes. Aha, good, I'm sorry. And in addition to resisting their unconstitutional efforts to legislate equal time for the presentation of a frankly religious view of cosmogony, and to thwart their success with crassly but understandably motivated book publishers, profit-motivated, the textbooks have been profoundly altered in the last 15 years by the lobby of creationists, not working through the courts, but working on boards of education and affecting their buying habits with respect to textbooks, such that the textbook publishers, anticipating that there may be some selection, natural selection or unnatural selection, if you will, against textbooks that deal with natural selection, have limited the treatment of this subject remarkably. And those books, which have been adopted by the more fundamentalist states, which happen to have the most children, I refer to California, Texas, as two of them. Once you have bulk buying by two populous states of this kind, it is quite understandable that the publishers of textbooks will aim their market at the dominant buyer and not worry to produce small versions for other areas which may have a different constitution in terms of their parentage and citizenship. In any event, they have been remarkably successful in this where they have not been successful in the courts. I would like then to make a modest proposal that directly acknowledges the plurality of society and attempts to accommodate this plurality in a way that is fairer to all parties. It can at least be said that our current education system, given the scope and content of its curriculum, which implicitly assumes that we are far more homogeneous as a society than we really are, at best ignores and at worst overrides the sensibilities of some of the legitimate interests and beliefs of some of its citizens that it serves, at least for some of the time. In particular, I do not believe it is fair within a nation that proclaims itself to be religiously free for children of parents of certain religious persuasions to be confronted with material in the context of a public school that runs counter to the central tenets of their religious belief. The same may be said of secular beliefs that provide the guiding principles of parents and their children. Apart from this fairness issue, there is, however, the state's legitimate interests in having its children prepared to become productive and responsible citizens of the state. How might one then meet, on the one hand, a diversity of parental expectations, and on the other, the state's rather constrained and conservative interests under the rubric of a publicly funded educational system? I propose that the system be devised by which the lawful interests of a diversity of parents and those of the state can be jointly served. The device turns on providing a split curriculum, the state's core curriculum delivering the instruction in the 3 R's and other relatively uncontroversial subjects would form the first part. And then there would be, in addition to this, a free choice curriculum offered by an array of private providers where students pay for their education through these providers, which would be chosen by their parents, of course, by state-financed vouchers. This arm's-length financing arrangement may be sufficiently remote as to obviate the state's entanglement or involvement with the establishment or free exercise of religion as is enjoined by the First Amendment of the Constitution. More importantly, its consideration, if not adoption, would be a move towards freedom of choice, one of the prime freedoms of a free society, and counter the all-too-common bureaucratic propagation of stultifying conformism that is characteristic and is delivered in the name of administrative efficiency. So I'll stop at this point and go to discussion. Thank you.
We have time for one or two brief questions.
Very quickly, the response, this refers to Bishop James Cooper, who has been a bishop down there. He is a dairyman also, and I think a 3 or 4 time legislator now. It is rather interesting that it's either 3 of the 4 or 3 of the 5 sponsors of the bill, there are LDS. It's also interesting that a lot of the pressure against the bill comes from the Latter-day Saint community as well, Lorenzo Lisenby and a couple of other luminaries down that way. The individual does indeed draw his alleged ecclesiastical support from a letter from one of our Council of 70 members. He has been shown first presidency statements, etc., on the issue, but chooses to believe that the statement from this member of the 70 supersedes those, and that he will proceed on that kind of basis. There's been a good deal more maneuvering there, but I believe that's about all I better say publicly.
We're out of time. We'd like to thank the panelists for their response today.